Hello, welcome to Our Dad's Died with Tom.
Gherkin.
And
Rich.
Spaulding.
This is a fun way of doing it from now on, I think.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. This week's episode is all about care homes.
Yes, care homes, care homes, care homes. The place you go to die. It's one way of describing them.
Care homes, care homes, care homes.
We interviewed the fantastic Pope Lonergan, who is a comedian and sometime care worker, who has written an incredible book, which we'll discuss a little bit more in the interview and later, called I'll Die After Bingo. And we talked to him about his experiences working in care homes, particularly during the COVID pandemic, which is when this was recorded. Pope is he's an incredible character. He is one of the most unique people I've ever met, and I love him. He's great on this. I think you'll really enjoy it. I'll stop talking now.
This episode, more than any other, really, I feel a duty to remind the listener that we are talking to somebody who is going to tell us some awful stuff. He's talking about the reality of life and death inside a care home. This means the bits you don't normally hear, and some people might find that hard to listen to, including us, as we frequently laugh when he says things that nobody should ever laugh at. But I just wanted to say that that's not really to be disrespectful. It's just it's really just our way of coping with terrible things.
Bit of a trigger warning. Pope does discuss suicide during the interview with him, and I say Pope discusses it, we also discuss it because that's how the discussion works. But if that's a trigger for you, if that's something you don't want to hear, then skip forward to the outro, which is at
56 minutes. So with that in mind, take it away, Popey!
That's one way of starting, isn't it?
Weird start.
So how long have you been working in care?
So I've been working in care near a decade now, about 9.5 years, I think. It was always in the same care home. It was the same environment. But then I went full-time in comedy at the beginning of 2019, kind of a bad time. So it was, you know, not soon after that, I was back into care again. When I went back to care, it's a different care home, and it wasn't elderly care anymore. It was like a mixture of like adults with dependent, like adults with like learning difficulties, or sort of lots of different things. Whereas, yeah, for the bulk of my career as a carer, I worked in the same care home.
So, end of life care, is that?
It's not so palliative care is a little bit. I didn't work in palliative care, but we did have end of life care within the care home, but it wasn't like eventually they've got to fucking like die eventually. Yeah. Like they die eventually. Yeah. They're kind of
It's very much the care home motto, isn't it? They've got to die eventually.
They've got to go. Sooner rather than later, please. We would have end of life care, but it would. It was long term residential care.
Gotcha.
That's how we described it. Yeah, because they were usually in there for quite a long time. I mean, I'd say the sort of the main kind of time period would be about 3 to 4 years, but then there was a lady I cared for that I was really close to. Cared for her for 9 years. She was in the care home for 15 years.
Wow.
And sadly, she died. I was really, really close to her, and she died a little just before kind of the first lockdown. And I hadn't seen her for quite a long time, because I'd quit my job there, and I sort of visited intermittently, but I hadn't seen her that much. And apparently she was kind of calling out my name right till the end. She still thought I worked there. Yeah, fucking that one hit me hard. That was like heartbreaking. So I couldn't go to a funeral either because of lockdown. And you kind of love them all in their own ways, but just like with any interpersonal relationships. There's some that you become very deeply involved with. They become like an extension of your family. You become very enmeshed in their lives.
Yeah.
But and then there's some that you kind of they're like third cousins or something. You tolerate them. They not really for you. Like not your kind of people. Yeah. Getting your nerves. But no, you love them all. But yeah, she was one that was in there for a long, long time. I cared about her a lot. So
and when you're very close to somebody like that, but it's still it's your job, it's a professional setting, but it's a very personal loss at the same time. How does that work when you're sort of part of your job is dealing with the death of someone that essentially, like you say, is family to you?
So yeah, it's really hard. This is something I've kind of brought up quite a lot, and I would bring it up a lot on the job, is that you don't get any kind, or it's not on my place anyway, you don't get any kind of grief counselling, and there's no, because it's, you know, private equity, it's run by private companies, and they're always worried about kind of just like profiteering or whatever. The moment someone dies, and they kind of, you know, they evacuate that room, they evacuate this world, and then they just bung another person in, and you don't get time to, there's no like period of like respite where you get time to kind of grieve that person or to have that, that period of, that kind of that lull in between the two things to you know, to grieve, basically. Mm. You don't really get an opportunity to grieve. That's the problem.
It's really interesting what you're saying, because when my dad died, it was about, I took a couple of weeks off work, but even then I felt I was sort of rushing myself / being rushed back to work, because it was the UK general election at the time and I had a bit of a role in it. So I kind of had to get back in there. And I felt like after reflecting on it, I didn't take long enough out of work to grieve that loss. And yet you're saying, you know, you got to know someone really closely. You saw them very often. And then what, I mean, you presumably you can't even really take time off work for that at all, can you?
No, God, like it really is part of the job. Like you become kind of very, it's kind of desensitized to it and a bit jaded by it. About a lot of these things that you kind of witness within the care home, and some of it, I think it's good because it allows you to develop a certain amount of tolerance, like stuff like the kind of body horror, like grotesque, like grotesque, like medical stuff that would usually people would find quite squeamish and off-putting. And then when they find that kind of stuff quite squeamish and off-putting, they tend to look away. When they tend to look away, that leads to neglect and deprivation. Whereas as carers, being able to confront that head on and sort of recognize the universality of these like biological degradation and the very corporeal parts of aging, there's a benefit to that. But it is hard when it's death you're dealing with, and there's not really a period for a kind of reflection. There's not really, it is just one out, one in. It's and then, as I said, yeah, we never got any kind of grief counselling or. And you know, I've seen so many people dead as well. That's the thing, yeah. I've seen people die in front of my very eyes. One lady died holding my hand. And that actually ended up turning up I'll get on to that. Like it ended up turning into a bit of a Weekend at Bernie's scenario. I'll do that quickly, right? So this lady, she sadly died holding my hand. She was looking a little bit rough in the morning. Mm. So I was monitoring her and keeping an eye on her, but like she wasn't on death's door or anything. Right. She was just a little bit quiet, a bit reserved. And I was in the lounge and like I just had a moment to, there's never really any moment to just kind of sit and be with the residents. So you have to kind of carve out that time yourself. And I just kind of sat with her and was holding her hand in the lounge. And to my right, there was like a little girl about 8 years old, a visiting family member. Right. And she was kind of chatting away and I was talking to her. And then, like, kind of looked at this poor lady and realized she's dead. Like, I realized she died. I sort of was, you know, like checking on her and that. So I could press the emergency buzzer as supposed to, and like all the other people, the carers and stuff rushed in. And there's this little girl right here, and we were all talking, going like, we don't know what kind of like exposure this little girl has had to death. Yeah. We don't want to corrupt her innocence, you know. So we've got these two responsibilities that we're kind of trying to balance. But also, like, we needed to remove this lady from the lounge where there is other people about, you know, as just as a health and safety thing, and also to kind of preserve her dignity. We don't want to just kind of sitting there, and there's got to be the undertakers and stuff come in, and the doctors and that. We had to end up like getting her into a wheelchair, and like sort of saying to the little girl was going like, oh, what's wrong with her? What's wrong with her? What's happening? We're like, oh, no, she's so tired. She is, oh my God. She is so tired. She's in a very, 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 very deep sleep. She's fine, though. She is fine. She's just, oh, God, you're tired. She's tired. And we had to end up getting her out and kind of I was going to say, we had to like end up like, you know, kind of prying her open. like she'd sort of stiffened up a bit with the
right.
Like she was like, get her on the bed like she was flat pack furniture. So, I apologize to the audience. I know that's going to sound very alienating to people, but it is sort of saying it for comic effect, but we did do it in the most respectful way possible. I'm a very religious person, so I believe in like the sanctity of death and stuff like that. I mean, we got her on the bed and did what the usual stuff we have to do, which is you obviously, when you die, everything inside you has to come out. And so we have to kind of clean the residents up and kind of prepare the dead. What we can to sort of, so that we can preserve their dignity, you know.
So when you say everything inside you has to come out,
yeah, go on.
Yeah, expand
so
on that.
Bodily fluids. So they is. I mean, I always think that people realize this in the same way that, like, you know, when someone's giving birth, they can shit themselves, but then it's surprising the amount of times people go, oh, I had no idea. They kind of, when someone passes away, they'll evacuate their bowels, they'll soil themselves, and we have to clean them up, get them changed. But it's very weird. It's like just the when you're like, I still, like, even when I'm doing the usual moving and handling, even though I know they're deceased, I still talk them through it as if I would a resident who's alive. Like, I'll go, I'm just, you know, just so they're not, so they're not confused or they don't feel violated or whatever. Oh, well, even though, like, they, with me, they were just, I'd looked after them so much that there was like a real trust, like they knew me very well and we were like, you know, very close and that. But yeah, still talking, you know, it's kind of weird, like, yeah, talking them through it. And it, when the lights go out, like the lights really go out, like there's just nothing there. It's kind of like a lump and mass of material. It's really strange.
I wanted to ask you about that because I think that's always stuck with me from, have you ever read Enduring Love, the Ian McEwan book?
Shit, no, I've seen the film, I think I bought the book. I never got around to reading it, but
it's all right.
Yes, I know there's, oh, right, yeah. August. So I know that there's always like a famous opening scene with the hot air balloon.
With the hot air balloon, yeah. Someone falls from the hot air balloon and the narrator sort of runs over. And it would be great if I could remember the phrasing of it now, but the way that he talked about suddenly being with this person but also being alone because he's dead, I always found a very, and it actually played a part when my dad died. I wasn't there, I was living away, and I came back and was given the opportunity to see his body, and I decided not to because I thought, I don't want to be in a room with my dad and also be alone. And you can't unsee it. And so is it very different? I've still never seen a dead body. Does it feel very different?
So what you, it's yeah. Like that, so what you said about being alone, that is the strangest part of it. When you're with someone else, you're with someone else. There's like another presence there. But when you are alone in the room with a corpse, it's kind of, you know. I'm kind of an etherealist rather than a materialist, so I do believe in like the continuation of some kind of cognizance or something. I don't know what. I believe in life after death, basically. But what it does not exist in that capsule that is left there on the bed. It does not exist in that kind of carapace that is that is left on the bed of the body. The body that is there's no longer got a spirit inside it. Whatever. It's really kind of weird. And like I write about it in the book. About one occasion I remember of being alone, kind of in a room with a resident who had died. Everyone else, it's kind of late in the evening as well. Just one kind of dimly lit, like pendulant light bulb, a kind of eerie atmosphere, and just being aware of like the silence, but not just the kind of oral silence. It's like a kind of cosmic silence or something. It was really kind of heavy. And because my usual response as a comedian is to kind of to undermine solemnity or to like catheterize experience and temporarily drain it of its misery or whatever, because I was feeling this really heavy emotion, didn't really know what to do with it, I was sort of standing there, and then I just went to the corpse. I just went, "You're fat." Such a I just thought in my head, like, what is the most inconvenient, like, what is the most inappropriate, what's the most inappropriate thing I could do in this moment? And in that moment, just by saying that, it kind of felt like that I was kind of reviving, reviving the relationship. Not that I ever called this person fat or anything like that, but I don't know why. It was irrational. That was the point. It was like an irrational response. For whatever reason, I haven't excavated it too much. I just felt I had to just say something, and I decided to just say, "You're fat." I think it's because I'd often seen them, and like, you know, they're she's a lady, had a bit of weight on her. Like, that's part of getting old as well. It's nothing in her fault. And I must have just thought it at some point. Thought, oh, you must never say that to a person because. You know, it's not very nice to say those sort of things, and then that was my final opportunity to get that off my chest.
It's the right if you're gonna tell someone they're fat, it's right to wait until just after they've died. Although you've got to hope.
Exactly. I'm a very moral person, you see.
Exactly.
So, I waited until they died. So.
But you were saying about the cognizance leaving the body. You've sort of got to hope that's true, because imagine if you just died and then someone went, "By the way, you're fat." You're like, "Oh, for fuck, I've just died, mate. Yeah. Give me a break." I'm having a rough day as it is. Yeah. I need to hear that.
Worst day of my life. Well,
This is literally this is the worst thing that's happened to me. Ease off, will you?
Kicking someone when they're down. It is a bit much, I suppose. It's funny, though. Do you know what it is? What really sticks out to me? And it's like what you were saying earlier about, oh, sorry if this feels a bit inappropriate, but I think what the listeners to this podcast will know by now is what me and Rich are about have been very uncomfortable talking about death and grief and struggling our way through that by laughing and laughing in places where it's not appropriate to laugh. It is, let's be fair, not appropriate to call someone fat after they've died. But that helps you get through that moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That was it. Like, for what Christ knows why I chose that, you know, particular method of kind of alleviating whatever I was feeling, the profundity of feeling I was that was inside me at that moment. But I know it's a word that's thrown around a lot, but it is quite cathartic to do that kind of stuff. But sometimes it can be inappropriate. I remember when my nan died and I told my mum I was going to use her as a toboggan, my dead nan. And Mum didn't, the problem was I love my nan, I loved her to bits, but it is just, there is that inside of me, unfortunately, which my mum actually probably understands quite well. We've both got quite a dark comic sensibility.
You just triggered a bizarre memory in me from when I was about 8, when my granddad had just died. And my mum had obviously said to my dad something along the lines of, take the kids out to go feed the ducks in the park, you know, so they're out of the house for whatever reason. And so he did, and we were messing about a bit. And we bought a loaf of bread and said, right, that's it. And he took the loaf of bread and he threw it in the bin. So we're just going home. So we went home. It was his dad who'd just died. So his dad had died, right? So, you know, I know what he felt like. Anyway, so we got back to the house and my aunt was there. And she was like, oh, what's wrong? And I was like, I just dead threw the bread in the bin. She's like, oh, yeah. And I went, first granddad dies and now this.
Like he said, exactly. Yeah, you're like the triple even.
Can you believe it? Yeah. God, the same day.
Two equally awful things have happened.
Yeah. In fact, it's just getting worse. The granddad died, which is bad enough, but then the fucking bread.
Oh, God, what next?
Yeah, I know.
Tells you a story about why this is how I deal with grief, because that was her dad who died as well, my aunt. And, you know, she laughed. I can remember picture her laughing at that. You know, it's what stuck in my mind. So obviously they trained me at an early age to laugh when people die.
Yeah, I think you've got to, like, I say it's a recurring trope in my stand-up, death. Like, there is something, I don't know what it is, there's something about death that I can really, yeah, like, it, this is why I was really excited to do this podcast. So obviously both of you are exactly the same. There is, like, a lot of comic potential in death. I don't know why, but some people can be really... can find that it's really off-putting and inappropriate, which is, I understand, that's probably a more natural, like, sane response, really. But yeah, there is part of me that just thinks, like, oh, come on, I don't know, like, what else are you gonna do with death? Like, there's only so, like, you obviously, you know, you should be able to grieve in the way you want to grieve and take as much time as possible in that grieving process, and I'd never deprive someone of that or like tell them how to grieve, but it feels healthy to at least find room for, you know, a bit of levity within your response to death. I think so anyway.
Yeah,
I might be wrong.
No, I agree. I think with anything, in any form of grief, you can't force people to respond. Like, it would be bad if we were like, you have to laugh about it. But I think it's okay to say, if you want to laugh about it, you should be allowed to. And that's kind of the idea of this podcast, was both of us sort of, I mean, like, as a comic, you'll know sometimes things happen and you think of something funny to say, and there's nothing more annoying than when you can't say that because it's not appropriate at the time. And I remember, I was obviously devastated when my dad died, but I was still funny. I still had funny stuff to say, and I was like, oh, I can't. And I'd make jokes to my friends, and because they were sort of, they'd never been through anything like that, and they didn't know what to do, they'd react awkwardly, and then I felt I couldn't really talk about it. Whereas sometimes you just, if somebody's willing to laugh about it, you've got to let them laugh. You've got to give them permission to laugh, and permission to cry, and permission to use their nan as a toboggan if they need to. Whatever gets you through. Why specifically a toboggan?
I have no idea.
Tobogganing around the streets of London.
Yeah, the streets of Essex. Oh. As well. Yeah, we all toboggan in Essex.
Famously.
I don't know why. I don't know what compelled me to say that. I was younger. I was like 13 years old. I might have just watched Cool Runnings or something. I don't know. But,
I thought you were going to say that you were 6. That you were 13. This is less excusable. Yeah. You were about to start your GCSEs. You can't get away with using there as a toboggan.
Tobogganing to a mock GCSE. Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I won't. I've actually, like, I used to always end my set with this bit, and it was long and drawn out. And then there's like a real like kind of sting at the end, like a kicker at the end. It always get a big response. But it is basically about elderly death and like the elders aren't having a good season. So I've taken it out of the rotation for the time being. But the kind of premise of it was like the impatience of death, like when. You know, I was with a woman and I thought it was going to be a real kind of cinematic ending, like just neat filmic end. And she was like chain stoking final breaths. And I was like, oh, she's gone. She's gone. And then she went, and I went, oh, not yet. And that happened three more times. And in my head, I was thinking like, why are you ruining your death for me? Like I was impatient.
That's a very good bit.
I was impatient, but I do remember, like, I was like, obviously I did, you know, I didn't say it out loud. It was just saying in my head, but I remember feeling a little bit impatient that she wasn't dying properly, which is very, you know, very ego-centric thing to.
It's funny you mentioned this idea about the end of life that you just mentioned there about, you know, some people feeling like, they're waiting for death almost. Yeah, I remember my gran before she died. This was during COVID. This was her like life perspective for the last year of her life. She was just like, I'm just so done, lads. Yeah. I've had enough of this. Let's just, shall we? Call it, you know what I mean? Just
wrap it up.
Wrap it up. I'm done. The moment my dad died, especially, she was just like, oh, come on. I've got cataracts. I can't even watch Friends anymore. You know. Is it worth this it without really friends?
those friends were everything to me. Lost my friends. I've lost my bloody friends.
When you can't watch Monica anymore, you know, what's really going on? It's quite an interesting perspective to take on, I thought.
Do you know what? That is really... Like it's quite kind of like they're the time that's quite common in the care homes, and I find it actually very it's really kind of good for my anxiety. It helps me in a way. I find it quite sort of liberating and beautiful in its own way, of like the resignation, like how resigned they are to death, where there's almost a cheerfulness in their anticipating their death. Like they'll talk about it like, oh, am I dead yet? Not quite yet, but maybe tomorrow. tomorrow's another day. Tomorrow's another day, or you know, hopefully not another day. Tomorrow it's quite nice when that happens, because they are they have kind of like settled into death. They have settled into death, which is, I mean, like, you know, for someone who's very, very old, it's fine. But obviously, you know, it's fucking tragic if you have, you know, you have a young person speaking in that way. That's not very nice.
Well, I suppose so. I remember my dad saying when he had as it turned out, he had a sort of a week and a half, a couple of weeks left, but we didn't know at the time. I remember having just chatting to him about stuff myself. Have you been reading anything lately? Because this is one of his books. And he actually said, well, there's no fucking point. There's no fucking point starting a new book now, is there? Like, he didn't want to almost get to the end and then not know how it finishes. But I was like, how will you know that you don't know how it ends? It's
but you don't want that to be your final thought, do you? You don't want to be like halfway through Game of Thrones and then be like, oh bollocks, and then you're dead.
Yeah.
Did Ross and Rachel get together in the end? Like, what's the deal there?
Did she get off the plane? No. That's it.
Do you feel like it's made you more or less ready? Because I feel like it could go one of two ways, couldn't it? Being so close and so involved in death constantly, does it prepare you more? Or
the one thing that did help me is that my mum actually died while giving birth to my brother. So in childbirth, my mum died like for, you know, how I can't remember how long. And she remembers it, and it was the usual thing of like seeing a white light, feeling bliss, kind of pure bliss, and just kind of, you know, submitting to what was coming next. And she said that's stopped her from ever feeling scared of death. And I was like, yeah, but imagine if you like fucking like that fit Quan Duck or something, like where you like set yourself on fire, like you just had like a nice blissful death, but you didn't have someone like decapitating you or something. You know, you didn't have like, you didn't like, you can't just go, like someone's cutting your, someone's literally like cutting your bloody head off. You can't just sit there and go, what a peaceful death, lovely. Just enter into the light while they remove my head.
Like Mel Gibson at the end of Braveheart, just peacefully slipping into another world as a man pulls his beating heart out. Yeah, it's not quite the same.
Just
like... I mean, does it bother you at all that your mum was clearly so welcoming of the possibility of death that she was giving birth to your brother and they went, you're dying now? She went, oh, fine. Almost. They brought her around. She was like, no, I was ready.
Like, mum, you've got fuck all fight in you, mum. Oh, God, I might need to have a word for her and say, like, please, like, fight a little bit more, mum. Like, if you just slip away,
give it a go.
Have a bit more fight. I want a couple more years with you left yet, but I don't know. I do actually worry about death quite a lot. I worry about my myself dying, not because I think, oh, I won't be here and, you know, all the things I could have achieved or anything. I know what it would do to my my parents, and I've tried killing myself twice. And I've had experiences where I've like OD'd like about 4 or 5 times now, and so yeah, I've had sort of them kind of experiences, and I know what it would do to my parents, so I do kind of worried about getting into that mindset again where I'm kind of want to die. You know, I don't at the moment, I don't want to die, I'm fine, but you just never know, do you? But
this might be a stupid question, I'm not sure, but you were talking about your mum not being scared of death because of her previous death. So when you're in that headspace that you've been in where you wanted to end your life, are you still scared of death, or is it no longer a frightening thing?
It's no longer frightening. That's the thing. It's, I always say to people, it's when the person who previously exhibited like very manic behavior or, you know, depressive behavior, whatever, when they suddenly seem better and like surprised, like, you know, in fact, there's been a drastic change in their temperament and they're fine now. That's the red flag, like that's the danger, because you, again, it's like that you're resigned yourself to death. And I remember I took myself to Amsterdam to try and kill myself because I thought it's like just lovely kind of tranquil canals. I was like, it's almost like dying and just like slipping into like a pastel drawing or like slipping into like an oil painting or something.
Wow.
Quite nice scenery, even though like the way I tried to kill myself was get a big gravel bag on my head and duct tape it to my fucking neck. Like, it's like
peaceful. Kind of
peaceful method. And then I actually ended up buying an hour of a sex worker's time, not to have sex, just so that to keep safe. And we ended up watching 2 episodes of the Good Place on Netflix, which is ironic because I was not in a good place. I was not. But we that's what happened. That was quite a nice experience looking back on it. But weird. And then the time I tried to kill myself before that, I can't really remember because I was sort of there's a bit of drink in the mix as well. And we'd gone to a trip for college. I had no friends in college apart from the tutors, like literally none. I had my friends, 3 friends outside who I've been friends with since I was a baby. But in college, had no one. I was apart from the tutors, and we went on this trip away to St. Ives, and there was like this me and this other girl who I never spoke to at all. But we were both kind of loners, in our own way. I thought like on that trip, I was going to like really, you know, like leave an indelible mark. I thought it was going to be like a showstopper if the showing question was my own life. So that's why I tried killing myself.
Jesus.
And but then she upstaged me by it. She fucking, like, after this happened, I was like the talking point. Not that I did it for that reason, but it, you know, it's
one of the upsides.
Cry for help. Yeah, it's running the ups. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Is that you go get a little sank for yourself.
Exactly.
And that was it. But then I got upstaged by a girl who ended the other girl, the weirdo, who ended vomiting up a fully intact autumn leaf. She vomited up a full leaf onto her cheek. It's really fucking weird. And it was so fucking weird. It was like a fucking like glitch in reality. We all saw it, but none of us acknowledged it. Like we all saw it. She quickly scraped it off her cheek like frantically and put it back in the pocket.
It was fucking funny. Right, nothing could have prepared me for that. There's so many questions. No, because it doesn't mean that she was eating leaves. It means she was swallowing them whole.
Yeah.
That's the only way.
Exactly. And the worst thing was, is like, so she was obviously like a bit of a social pariah. I was a social pariah because of, for other reasons, but she was like, so because I tried killing myself on a fun holiday.
Yeah, she was just swallowing fucking leaves.
Yeah, for fucking leaf eater. No. Burping up.
No, not leaf eater. Leaf swallower. No chewing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Burping up the fucking season.
Oh my god.
She was on the phone. She was on the phone afterwards, like with her legs up on the wall, like talking to her mum, really upset and that. And I could hear her talking. She was going, yeah, like really quiet and timid. And going, yeah. It's not going too well. And then there's like a pause and she went, yeah, it happened again.
No way.
Why are you fucking eating leaves? It's so weird. Like, it is. The problem is, we never followed up on it, so it's like none of us could confirm like what we'd seen. It was so weird, and like me and this other guy were always like talking about going like that was a fucking leaf, wasn't it? That was like, I'm not making it up, am I? That was a full fucking leaf, wasn't it? Like, we had to like reaffirm to each other that we've seen it.
Pope, that's the funniest thing I've heard in years.
What's great about that is that even for you, the highlight of that holiday wasn't your own suicide attempt.
I know.
It was a girl vomiting up a whole leaf.
I know, she fucking upstaged me. And flaps in her cheek. Oh, it's so funny.
Weirdly, I had my mate Simon in high school, this is not relevant to death at all, but he once sneezed out a whole grape. And he swears he never inhaled a grape, but a fully intact grape.
See, that shit happens. It does happen. And it always sounds like that can't possibly be the case. But yeah, it does. It's so fucking weird.
What I was going to ask was, you mentioned earlier that you're a Quaker. And how does that... Because I'm like, me and Tom are both atheists. But one of the things I'm fascinated talking to people about is sort of what you believe either happens after you die, or what your sort of take on the afterlife is, and whether that changes the way you think of death, your own death, other people's death.
Well, could you give us a quick sum of what Quakers are first, and then get into it?
Quakers are basically like a Christian denomination, but like a lot of Christian denominations, they were at one point heretics, and they don't believe in like idolatry. They don't believe in holy places. They believe that there is an innate godliness within all of us, So it's like a very like communitarian religion. And you can just do, I mainly picked it, it's like you can do at home quaking. You don't even have to go to the Quaker house. You can just, I'm quaking right now, mate. It's like a very lazy bones religion.
At home quaking.
Yeah. And afterlife, it was a question about the afterlife. Do you know what? I've got weird ideas about the afterlife.
Let's hear them.
Yeah.
So there's this philosopher, I think he's Danish, don't know how to pronounce his name. There's a lot of argument about how to pronounce his name, but it's G-E-U-L-I-N-C-X. Right. And
do you want to have a punt at pronouncing it just for fun?
Goulinks
it is.
Goulinks.
They are fucking Goulinks.
Golly Goulinks.
Well, I don't know about that. But
Samuel Beckett's kind of favorite philosophers, especially when it came to the idea of the far away non-interventionist God, and that you basically had a God who was the catalyst for kind of cosmic expansion, and then just looked the other fucking way. So just kind of went, make all this, and then looked out the window. And is kind of a God that's completely insulated from all human or, you know, animal activity. And he, yeah, basically made the world and looked out the window. And I believe, as a kind of weird, like, talisman is the right word, I think. When I was really little, I went to a hoarder's house. A lady used to look after me briefly. Went to her house, looked under a sofa, found a little bit of sweet corn. And it just, for some reason, it disgusted me that it was just one singular little nugget of corn rather than like a pile of corn. Like, I would have rather like a full pile, but it's just one single corn.
Nugget's the word.
Yeah. Like one little nugget of corn, like kernel, is it, or whatever. And then, so that's fine. Then I went home and went back 4 years later and looked under the sofa, the same little, but very dehydrated little bit of corn. And I've kind of applied this idea of this faraway Goulinksian God to this little bit. For some reason, there's been like a symbiotic connection between the two in my head, of like this little corn that basically what I'm saying is, within my prayer rituals, I've got these three Orthodox saints I all called Frank after my granddad. They're Russian Orthodox saints, I don't know the actual words. I pray to them, and I also pray to this perennial corn, I call it. And it's like there's some kind of weird like religious continuity between this little corn that existed under a mile hoarder's sofa. So that's my religious practice, really. And we've all got that. We've all prayed to a little bit of corn.
Yeah. I suppose beyond praying to the corn, I think the question was about whether there's an afterlife. And I think I really need to press you on an answer. Yes or no?
Yeah. No, you're right.
What's happening?
Okay. Yeah, okay. I'll be succinct. Like, just yes.
Yes. You don't have to be succinct. Well, that is quite funny.
After all that,
within 10 minutes, yes, on corn, afterlife, you got one word.
I quite like that. Yeah, afterlife.
That's
yeah,
quite funny. Yeah.
This is, again, maybe an oversimplification, but when you were talking about praying to a God that you also believe isn't listening, but it's sort of the little bit that you can do just on the off chance. Maybe it is an oversimplification, but it almost feels like quite a nice analogy for your care work, because you know that what you're doing isn't going to change what's inevitable, but you're doing your little bit in the meantime. Does that make sense?
That's really like a really, really great way of thinking about it. Absolutely. That's exactly like I always say, it's about managing your expectations on like what you can achieve. And if you can achieve, you know, like just moments of engagement. So I'll give you like a, for instance, like there's one lady that I cared for her for 3 years, and we were very close, and she would get quite aggy with a lot of other carers. Mm. Always felt very confident with me. And we'd always recognize, like, couldn't quite place how she knew me, but recognized me and knew I was like a comforting presence. Didn't know my name for 3 years or kept forgetting my name, but knowing, oh, I know you, I know him. Eventually, even though, you know, she had frontal lobe dementia, neurodegenerative disease, and had a kind of memory formation was very impaired for like present day memory, new memories. But then after that 3 years, for some reason, she suddenly just started remembering my name. And she just, I thought I'd just had an impact where with persistence and, you know, being part of her life for that amount of time, she suddenly just, it just locked, just locked in her head. And then she remembered my name from then on. And just, yeah, things like that of just, yeah, little moments of kind of engagement and connection and just, you know, moments of tenderness and like delicacy of feeling. Just like one guy who I just helped, he had a terrible, terrible anxiety. Just very briefly for about an hour, I helped to reduce his anxiety by kicking a box of tissues around like football. Like, and we were just sitting in a bedroom. So he liked being with people. So he would be with me while I made the beds, and he would like help me just, you know, take the corners and, you know, put the duvet cover on. He'd just follow me about and help me do that. And then I'll just like, he just threw a tissue box on the floor and I sort of kicked it a little bit and went, I do goal, like that. And then went up to the cabinets and was like going like that, as if like, oh, look, this is the goal. And then I just played a little bit of kickabout with him, and it for like his agitation was so extreme, and just for an hour it like reduced it to where it was like wasn't there, just from that little activity, and me just kind of like chatting and stuff. And things like that would happen, you know it would happen a lot with different residents, but yeah, but then it was always peaks, you know, peaks and troughs, or one step forward, two steps backwards. It was always that sort of thing. But it was just, yeah, nice to know that a gilded moment, I'd call it. Like, you know, you just get a moment where like their symptoms are reduced and they're feeling happy or positive or, you know, whatever.
And it's really nice. It's a very human story. And I think particularly the last year and a half, there's been a lot of kind of dehumanization of older age people, because during the pandemic, there's been a lot of talk of, well, it's only old people dying. And while there's, you know, there's an argument of they've had more of a life, it breeds this thought of people in care homes are not people, whereas you spend your whole life with them and they're all human and they all have lives and stories and personalities.
Exactly that. And like, I've had to stop kind of reading certain op-eds and stuff and Twitter, because it can fill me with real kind of rage and anger. And like, I understand the kind of utterly rational argument for a form of like bureaucratic triage in hospitals, where you are going to prioritize younger patients. Of course, that's the way it should be. It's fucking horrible that we've got to at that point, but that, well, we're sort of slightly beyond it now, hopefully. But it did get to that stage, and I understand the justification for that. But with that, even with recognizing that as a necessity, it doesn't mean, like you said, you then need to deprive these people of their humanity or think of their life as like a protracted, drawn out cessation or death. It's madness how kind of common that viewpoint can be, even amongst like relatives sometimes, like where they talked about their mum or dad or whatever, like as if they're already dead and they're literally sitting next to them. They're not sitting next to them. I've had to say to a relative, like, oh, it's right, we'll leave your mum near and we'll talk outside, because mainly I don't feel comfortable, you know, doing that. And people shouldn't think about these human beings as if they're already dead when they're not. A lot of this stuff, like the rhetoric around social care and care work and how sort of dehumanizing it can be, it can really, really anger me. I'm hoping, if there's one thing that I can do, like when the book comes out, you know, you get a bit of a platform talking about those issues, I hope that is something where I can shift the needle slightly in that view of aging and of the care home life. I think there are also a lot of good people like yourselves who recognize that, you know, these are people who still have robust personalities, even, you know, slightly diminished and or they're not even diminished, just kind of changed. They're just their personalities and their lived existence have just kind of, it's just kind of changed and turned into something else. But sorry, I was rambling a bit there. I apologize.
No, it was a great answer.
It's really good. Yeah. We've been talking for a while now, and you know, we won't have all of your time from you forever. I promise this podcast will end one day. but one thing we like to do on the show is we like to try and give the listener a sort of guide, if you will, an idea for different ways of dealing with things when someone close to you has died. And I was just wondering if we could get back to how you mentioned, you know, how you do deal with death. And particularly, you know, when someone, whether it's someone who you've known for 9 years or whether it's someone you've known for a few months, what's the way that you are able to deal with that?
It's lovely that's part of the podcast. That's such a, will be really helpful to a lot of people. I mean, for me, I've obviously had to do this, because I am writing a book. But even just like beside that, just I'm someone who's kind of kept journals and notebooks and stuff since I was 7 years old, and I've wrote down some recollections of, like, say, for instance, that resident I was telling you about, I looked after for 9 years, as like you know, the stuff that's committed to memory, and I've tried to write it down as like a short, you know, short story template or whatever. And a lot of the people really I've written about in the book have died now, and I kind of brought them, it really brought them into relief as like characters and with their idiosyncrasies and fully well-rounded personalities by just writing a scene of, committing it to record, and like and that's a way to, you know, the indelibility and the legacy that we seek, that I'm sure everyone wants to leave a residue on this earthly plane. That might be just a very small way of doing it, of writing down your recollections of that person, or even just one recollection, just that you think sums them up as, you know, the role they played within your life. I think that's a nice way of doing it. Yeah, just kind of writing down, like writing a thing, you know, committing them to the page is quite a nice way of doing it. I think I find it quite helpful to do that kind of stuff anyway.
Yeah, that's a very practical bit of advice, and I think it gets to one of the problems with grief, at least I've found, is balancing how you think about that person, because there can be two approaches, which is that you think about them all the time or you try to not think about them at all. And I think part of dealing with grief is just working out how much to think about them and how to think about them without that.
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, writing down something that's not related to the fact that they're dead, that is just a story from their life. Again, it's that thing of, it humanizes someone. And that's certainly one of the things that I find with my family, is just talking about my dad, not being like, oh, isn't it a shame that he's not around anymore? Just being like, do you remember how much he used to fart? I mean, it was like, it's weird, the sort of the memories that you get, because he in the morning used to have a coffee and immediately do a shit, like immediately.
Yeah, I'm like that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I've gradually started to become that person that I have to have a coffee first thing, and I immediately have to do a poo. And there was a day where I was doing it. I was like, oh, I'm like Dad. It's a weird way to get nostalgic, sitting there on the loo.
I love that. That shitting is like an homage to
makes me feel closer.
Yeah, and it is, weirdly enough, it is those kind of almost like quite kind of quotidian memories, or, you know, quite kind of that's like the stuff of living, isn't it? So it's not even like the big, you know, the big elaborate events of their life. It's like these little details that, you know, you could turn into a vignette on the page or whatever. It's like what one thing I know with my dad, like, he's alive obviously, but when I kind of think of him is ever since I was young, he's always had kind of like deep frown lines or like deep recesses in his head. Mm. And I've just the thought of like frown lines is quite a strange thing and something. And also the fact that my dad used to, as a someone again, like a detective, used to walk around the town in bare feet, like a lot, like just quite a, like he used to walk around like, you know, when you're on holiday and you kind of walk around with just like a towel on and flip flop.
Yeah.
He would do that in like South End in Essex. Like it was quite, and it's all little details like that, that if you can capture them, you know, in whatever way possible, like is, yeah, that's the kind of stuff that has the most potency, I think, rather than, you know, like the really kind of big events. Yeah, so I think that's great. I love that with your dad sort of just doing a really big shit and being like, this is I'm carrying it, you've passed me the torch, Dad. You passed me the torch. It's lovely, you know, it's really
so nice. Basically we've got three ways of dealing with death here. We've got writing it out as a lovely journal, doing a poo, or of course the classic, asked to ride them as a toboggan.
yeah, exactly. There you go. Perfect. There you go.
The woman threw up a leaf, Rich.
That is, astonishingly, that's the headline of that whole episode. All the amazing stories and the very poignant moments and the really funny lines from Pope. What anyone is going to come away from that episode thinking is, how? How and why?
The practicalities of it is something that I'm still not getting to. And this notion that she wasn't eating the leaves, because that involves chewing. She was somehow swallowing leaves. She was swallowing leaves.
And that's not something you do by accident. And then
exactly. You can't accidentally swallow a leaf.
And wasn't the line she said on the phone to her mum, "It happened again"?
It happened again. Yes. If we assume that that's real and not just a punchline, then I. She's constantly swallowing leaves.
Yeah.
She's not producing them from nowhere.
Yeah. Wow. What an episode.
Really funny, really serious, really earnest.
Yeah.
At home quaking, I've got written down.
Yeah. Pope is amazing. And when we recorded that, he hadn't yet released his book, I'll Die After Bingo. The speed that we move at on this podcast means that since we recorded that interview, he's written and released a book, which has been out for quite a long time now. I've read it. It is genuinely fantastic. And I started reading it in an airport, and I finished it. I think I'd almost finished it by the end of that plane journey. It really is that readable and funny and moving and just a deeply sort of kind and caring book that I think makes you want to be a better person, genuinely. It made me want to be a better person reading it. So if you haven't read it, buy it. I'll Die After Bingo. In all good bookshops, I assume. Probably actually not anymore. Amazon?
I wouldn't have thought so anymore.
Maybe not Amazon.
Amazon's there, but you can do any Google. Just Google it and then you can find it.
Yeah.
Non-Amazon themed bookshop. Or Amazon. I'm not one to tell you where to buy your stuff from. Buy it from Amazon.
Yeah.
Don't. All fine.
Yeah. Yes.
Don't do both, though, because that's a waste of money. Unless you're gifting it. But then probably that's a waste of the planet.
Yeah, lots to think about. Get it on a Kindle. Get it on your mate's Kindle. It as an audiobook. Or you can get it as an, if you enjoyed Pope's voice.
Is it an audiobook?
He's done an audiobook of it, so you can do
that's
that.
Great. That's great. I've got Audible. Should I get it on Audible?
Get it on Audible. Genuinely, all joking aside, I absolutely loved it, and I think it's brilliant and quite an important book. However you can get your hands, eyes, or ears on it, do it.
And I'm sure if you live in London, you can see him, you can hear him live as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He's rounded about. Right, I think before we go, we should remind our wonderful listeners of the best way to help this podcast if you're a fan and you'd like to help it.
Please, just go on iTunes and rate, review and subscribe. We've re-recorded this like 10 times because I keep swearing. Can you please just go on iTunes? and click five stars, or Spotify, click the five stars. That's all. Whenever you do that, you bring us just that bit closer to you know, more people listening.
Yeah.
So if you haven't done it yet, it's just so easy to do. Why do you know? Just click the button, man.
You're sounding desperate now. Listen, if you've got...
But just click it.
If you've got time and you'd like to help us out, leave a review and a rating. Also, follow us on social media. We're putting a bit of content out now, even though I hate saying that. OurDadsDiedPod@gmail.com.
Or just go on social media, @OurDadsDied, on Instagram or Twitter. We've already had several people leaving us lovely comments on Instagram on these videos, as well as sending us messages. We do reply to our messages, so you know, do send one, and that'd be fantastic. And we'll put it in the bank for when we do our episode called Your Dad's Died, where we talk about the death of your dads and other family members.
Yeah.
And friends.
And friends. What a way to end. Thank you very much for listening once again. We'll be back next week. And until then, just remember, death comes to us all.
But it comes to you first.
We're outside your house. Bye.